Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 19, delivered on November 4, 2015. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model, one of the culminations of a finance course, a survey finance course. If you go any further in finance, you will hear this brought up again and again. It is a cornerstone of our subject, our field. It's been around being used for, almost a half century now. And it has had its share of criticisms over the years and attacks and alternatives to it offered. But it still stands as a pretty darn strong model. But before I get to that, going back to the subjects from before, the expected return to a portfolio. Now, I'm going to write these without expecteds on them. And I'm going to deviate a little bit from the book because its notation gets so big that it kind of loses sight of what's trying to be made, the points it's trying to be made. So when I write an R, that's an expected return. And when I write a sigma, that is a standard deviation. Now the book writes SD parentheses. So R sub I would be the expected return to security or portfolio I. Sigma sub I would be the standard deviation of returns to security I. And a couple of other ones here. R sub M would be the expected return to the market portfolio. Or to the market portfolio. And I'll do one more here to shorten the notation a little bit. Now, the book would write this E, a big capital E parenthesis, capital R sub I. This one it would write as SD open parenthesis R sub I. This one would be the expected E open parenthesis R sub MKT, etc. I'm just trying to kind of clean up the notation more the way we would actually do it if you were in a higher level course. One other one is the Greek symbol rho, which is typical for rho sub I j, would be the correlation, the Pearson correlation coefficient between returns to securities I and J. Now don't sweat. It looks like I'm getting ready to write a whole lot of math. I'm just going to write not that much math, but I'm just trying to make it a little bit more compact in your notes and get you a little more familiar with how we would write it out. First things first. Now, you know, as I said before, that the expected return to a given portfolio would be the sum from I equals 1 to N of the individual weights in the portfolio times the return to each. Add them up. Just take the weight of each security in your portfolio times the return on that, expected return on that portfolio. Just add them up, and there's your expected return to the whole portfolio. Nothing fancy about that. Just take the, it's a weighted average. Pain in the ass part is the standard deviation. Now, I won't even try to write the general standard deviation in a portfolio of stocks. I'll write it out for two stocks just to knock you dead here. The standard deviation of a portfolio of two stocks, I and J, would be the weight of stocks, of two stocks. Let me just put one and two. I'll just do one and two instead of all this notation. The weight of stock one in the portfolio squared times the standard deviation of returns of that stock squared plus the weight of stock two squared in the portfolio times the standard deviation of returns to stock two squared plus the weight one times weight two times the correlation between the two stocks times the standard deviation of one times the standard deviation of two. That would be the variance of a portfolio of just two stocks. Imagine what this son of a bitch looks like if you put in about 20, 50, 100 stocks. That's when it gets to be way too much like work. So I made sure one of the questions on your test had 18 stocks. No, I don't want my tires slashed. That's long enough. Now, if you are a probability and stats jockey, one of the mavens who like that, you would notice that that last thing there is actually the correlation coefficient times standard deviation 1 times standard deviation 2. That is actually something called covariance. Covariance is the multiple data vector version of a variance. And I'm curious about this. When you were in your stats class, whether it was in econ or over here in MQM, did they show you... Did they show you something called ANOVA tables, analysis of variance, the ANOVAs? Well, this is what you would pull, that covariance thing, which is actually the same as that mess there on the end, that correlation coefficient times sigma 1, sigma 2. That is what you would pick off an ANOVA table, an analysis of variance table. You remember those things that kind of like a big mess they were? And you just have Excel do those. You don't even try to do those on your own. But that's what that thing is. This is the same thing. This right here is the same thing as saying covariance of two things against each other, how they are pulling together through time. And you notice that covariance actually doesn't say as much as if you break it down and you say, all right, you've got the product of each one's individual volatility times the correlation between them. So you notice that you could have two stocks that are wickedly volatile, but if their correlation coefficient is very small, that would mean that they are not going to contribute much to, oh, I should put this as a squared. I'm sorry, that's a squared there. That would not contribute too much to the volatility of the portfolio. Let me say that again. This last term here can create a lot of volatility in a portfolio. If these two are fairly significant and their correlation between them is high, well, that would add a lot to the variance of the portfolio. But if these two are high, but there is hardly any movement of them that is coordinated, then you've got a more interesting situation because then this last term is not contributing much to the variance of the portfolio's returns itself. So you kind of keep that in the back of your mind. That's why we write it out this way sometimes, just to point out that it's not so much how volatile stocks are in a portfolio as much as it is how much there is correlation among the volatilities in the portfolio. So the interesting thing is that I've even seen social scientists, and I've made a couple of comments about this myself, that a lot of societies imagine that the less people act oddly, or the better off the society is, the less volatile, the less dangerous a society is. Well, if you look at this in, from a social science kind of point of view, no, that's not the real issue. It's how much of this volatility, this variance in thinking, in philosophy, in political activity, how it's correlated. If there's not a lot of correlation, it's not hurting much at all. But that's kind of getting outside of the realm of this course, and we don't do a lot of philosophy in finance unless we're really drunk. But I do want to show you something. Before I move on, I do want to show you a couple of screens here, and as a general rule, I would probably do this as more of an Excel thing. That was fun. Anyway, okay, asset correlations. Let's talk about, up here what I have is portfoliovisualizer.com. I kind of like this site because, watch it though, there are a number of sites that will do these correlation matrices, showing you the correlations among stocks. Some of them, absolutely, they're dead wrong. I mean, you can even look at them and you can say, that can't be right. This one, as far as I can tell, and I've done a couple of them on my own just to make sure, and this one so far is okay. Now, what this is going to do is this is going to show you the correlation coefficients among stocks in a, like, in a matrix fashion. So maybe throw in Target. What else would you like to throw in there? Walmart? What is Walmart? WM? Walmart. WMT? Okay. WMT. WMT. What else? No, ooh, there's one. Find a symbol. No, that's an ADR. Yeah, that's an ADR.
What about Hershey's?
Hershey's. I'm very... No, that's an ADR. Oh, the Hershey, HSY. I don't think that's the same one, is it? Maybe it is. HSY? What else? Throw in something else that's out there. Is that part of the limited, or is that on its own? Yeah, limited, which I ought to put that in there anyway. I come from where the limited was, its base was. Why is that acting weird? The limited. Wait a minute, what the heck? That's bizarre. Limited. I could have sworn Limited was a publicly traded company. You just did that. I could have sworn. How about Abercrombie and Fitch? A&F. That's close enough. Wait a minute. Let me try something here. No. Why did you make me type that in? Now they're going to track me. You know, pervert in a classroom looking for Victoria's Secret. Abercrombie. Really? Abercrombie and Fitch, A&F. We'll do that one. A&F. Trying to think. Well, let me just do something off the wall. Let's do Ford. Okay. Now, I'm going to let it do the 60 trading days, view the correlations. Okay, now the nice thing about this is that it'll show you the annualized rates of return of the different components of this kind of bizarre portfolio. And of course, the matrix will be it's symmetric top and bottom, of course, because it's a matrix. So you really want to look at only one. Now, Walmart against Target. Notice that's not as surprising. That's a fairly robust correlation coefficient. You see it? 0.58. Remember, it runs technically between negative 1 and 1, but usually it's between 0 and 1. You see that high correlation coefficient right there, Walmart against Target? Okay, Hershey against Target, well, they don't have a whole lot in common, and that's not really all that surprising. Abercrombie against Target, that's getting a little bit more because they're both essentially apparel. Target is boring college student. Abercrombie is creepy post-adolescent. So, there's a connection there. Ford against Target. Notice that Ford really doesn't have a high correlation against any of them, because it's essentially a manufacturing, it's an industrial, more of an industrial company. Now, if I were to put Ford against GM, you probably would see more of a core. Matter of fact, let me do that. That's kind of interesting. Ford, General Motors is, GM, yeah, that's what I thought it was. Let's do put GM and throw GM into the mix. And do it again. Ford, oh, hey, see it? Look at that. I mean, very high degree of correlation. That's the thing that you want to avoid. If you're trying for portfolio diversification and you're not having a giant portfolio, this is the kind of thing that magnifies. You see what I mean? If you've got something like a pair of stocks that are a 0.29, see how a 0.29 is going to minimize the impact of the volatilities of the two individually. But when you got 0.71, that's strongly encouraging that the individual volatilities to come through on the portfolio. And one of the things that I always try to do, at least I usually try to do it, is if I write you a stupidly big formula, I try to explain, well, this is what this formula is capturing, and you can see it right there. You put Ford and General Motors together, that correlation coefficient is not going to do anything to dampen their individual volatilities. But if you put Target together with Ford, or Target together with Hershey, the 0.27 is going to suppress the sigma 1 times sigma 2. It's going to ease it off. Go ahead.
Doesn't this correlation principle kind of make it silly to, stocks in electricity?
Exactly. And that was what I was talking about. Those sector portfolios are actually a very bad idea. If you're trying to diversify your portfolio, the sectoring is going to make you're going to have high correlation coefficients, so they are going to feed each other's volatility. But and that's why, I don't know, if I were to buy, okay, suppose that I really, really like electricity, okay? You know, it's been with me my whole life. God knows every time I try to do wiring, I end up meeting electricity, which is surprisingly related to death. But at the same time, I would want to find, so I can get a mutual fund that deals in electric utilities. But what I would probably want to do is get other mutual funds that are completely outside of that area. The same thing is true of high technology. Well, I invest only in high tech. Well, you're an asshole. Or I invest only in green stocks. Well, goody for you. You're not investing intelligently.
unless you are going to go into a mutual fund that is, say, green, and also go into mutual funds that are something completely different. And you can actually run this, by the way, on mutual funds too. They have trading symbols, so you just put in some trading symbols for different mutual funds. Okay, I really want to put stock into a portfolio of, let's say, green companies or companies that have a high degree of social responsibility, that kind of thing. But at the same time, what I would also want to do is find other mutual funds that meet some of my own personal goals and put those in there and make sure that the correlation coefficients between them were small, so that you did not get that feeding thing within it, that feeding frenzy of a high correlation coefficient making these guys magnify each other on the portfolio's uptake. That is the, as far as I'll go with you on correlation coefficient, it's enough to get you started if you are interested in personal investing and in thinking beyond just, well, I heard a friend of mine say I should buy this stock. You can begin to look into these yourself. And again, if you're looking for correlation coefficients, go to portfoliovisualizer.com, asset correlations. You can also download spreadsheets in Excel that will do the same thing for you if you want to really feel butch without actually having to write the code itself, which can be way too much like work. But moving on from there, I wrote down another website. I can never remember these websites off the top of my head. I bookmark everything. Just a couple of cautions. Correlation coefficients, and I'm going to put these to you very, with the caveat. Correlation coefficients are a very good thing. There are some naysayers out there who will say, well, correlation coefficients look only at linear relationships. There could be these deeper quadratic relationships or these complex log linear relationships, whatever. Yeah, they are out there, but I mean, how far do you want to go before you are really losing sight of the point, which is to invest? Yeah, correlation coefficients measure only linear correlations between stocks, but at the same time, the linear relationships do tend to dominate all relationships. Another criticism that gets on a deeper probability theory level is that correlation coefficients deal only in the first two moments. The first moment is the fancy word for the average. The second moment about the mean the second moment about the first moment is what we call the standard variance. There might be higher degree relationship, third degree, fourth degree. Well, there actually probably are. But again, how far do you want to go in analyzing this before you get actually begin to offend yourself with being such a geek? I'm not going to go any further beating up on the correlation coefficient. I did have another website here. Okay. Getting to that market portfolio, that theoretical portfolio, the pure, true market portfolio would take every stock in the world or in the economy, let's say, the economy. Its contribution to the portfolio would be its market cap relative to the complete portfolio of the market. And that, add all those up, and that would be a market portfolio. It can't be done. It's a theoretical animal. So what we have to look at instead is what we call a proxy for it, something that is approximately that thing, the market portfolio. And I've brought up a few in the past. The Standard & Poor's 500 companies, in terms of those 500, they are a tiny percentage of the number of companies in the country or in our economy or in the world. However, as far as their contribution to the market cap of the entire world, The S&P 500 reaches about 65-70% of the size of the entire, it is about 65-70% of the entire weight of the market cap of the world, or at least of the American economy. That should actually kind of scare you, that 500 companies are close to three-fourths of the entire economy of the country. That's a little concerning, and that was one of the reasons we were very concerned, even the conservative, libertarian, whatever, Adam Smith started bawling his eyes out about the possibilities of monopolies and oligopolies taking over industries. Well, now we've got it so that we've got essentially 500 companies that have taken over the entire economy. And it's going to get worse, only worse, as you get into your productive and years as a worker and as a household person, as the head of a household. So keep that in mind. Probably as far as using a market indicator goes, I don't know. The S&P 500 is a good one. Because we need to know what the expected return to the market portfolio is. The S&P 500 isn't the worst place to start. Now, in my business, we need to know the expected return to the market. I'm going to write down here, just for your purposes, something that I did a back of the envelope calculation. Now, this is really off the cuff, in terms of the terminology, not the number. The number is a little bit old because I haven't done it for some months now, but here we go. Remember that you've got a portfolio. There are going to be two ways that you make money in a portfolio. Madam, what are those two ways?
Returns.
Yes, returns. What returns?
Return on your investment. Expected return.
You're looking at me like I just asked you to eat a turd sandwich. Do you remember there are two ways that you make money off of stock? What are they?
Dividends.
Yes, and?
Returns.
Capital gains, returns. Returns, what the hell? Okay, there are two ways to make money off of stock. Capital gains and the capital gains and the dividend. The capital gains yield and the dividend yield. Taking a really wide swath, and this would include the Standard Poor's 500, glomming up about 1,000 other companies that are just under the S&P 500, I can probably gather about 90,000 companies. About 90% of the market portfolio. So I'm kind of close here. This is not a bad one. Now, as far as, and this is historical. Now, remember, this isn't expected. This is historical. And there's a big difference between what has happened and what will happen. But if you're looking for the expected return to the market portfolio, MKT, I would do the capital gains yield plus the dividend yield. Now, doing this for recent times, up maybe until a few months ago, the capital gain yield, and I wrote down what I had gotten, it's about 12.5% capital gains yield. And the dividend yield on that mass of companies overall, on average, is right now running at about 2.40%. So the expected return to a pure market portfolio, the theoretical animal, this is my best attempt at describing it, would be about 14.90% right now. 14.90% right now. This is one of the
two big components, one of the big components of what's called the capital asset pricing model, which is how we can get the expected return to a stock or to a portfolio. Okay, now, one other thing that I'm going to need here in a little bit, not right now. This is called the risk-free rate. It is part of the theory of the capital asset pricing model. Now, I don't know if you remember this. I talked about it early in the course, back when we were young. We were excited about the future. Indeed, we were in love. Yeah, I know. Do you remember what I said? Can you tell me something that is a riskless security, as close as we have in the real world to a riskless security?
T-bill.
Yes, a T-bill. Now, for a long, long time, I would have said we proxy the risk-free rate with a T-bill yield. However, I have found, and I guess I can see some merit in this, that a lot of practitioners don't use the T-bill, a very short term, like a 3-month T-bill, annualized T-bill yield. They're not doing that. They're using a 7 or a 10-year T-bill yield right now. And I've actually asked some of the people who do this, the practitioners, well, why aren't you using that very short term T-bill? And they said, well, because, look, you're talking about stocks and bonds and capital asset pricing models and betas over securities that are that survive for a long period of time. And yet what you would be using with a T-bill is you would be mismatching a maturity. A T-bill is a very short-term instrument. And you're using that in something that is you're looking at for very long-term investments? No. So what they use instead, interestingly enough, is a 7-year or a 10-year treasury note. That's the popular one these days for the R sub F. And you might even have heard me say, well, we'll use a 3-month T-bill yield. Well, I got to watch myself because anymore, that ain't what they're doing. They're using a 10-year note. Right now, I just looked at a yield curve, and I swear, I thought I could remember it long enough to get to class, but I'm not sure I did. Right now, I think about a 10-year T-bill is about 2%. So we're proxying the R sub F with a 10-year T-bill yield, which is running right now on the yield curve at about 2.00%. There you go. And the return to the market portfolio is about 14.90%. Now, another component of the capital asset pricing model is the infamous beta. The beta of the security, okay? That will depend upon the security. Now, cool thing, very cool thing, is Yahoo Finance actually has a beta screener. You can actually have it tell you, give me some betas. Let me see them. All in a row. Suppose that I feel like looking for someone who looks wild and crazy. You, woman. Okay, you are a, what kind of a beta woman are you? Well, I mean, if you want to talk about it that way, but I mean, look, we're bikers here. We're beta kinds of people. We don't say risk takers. We say we're beta people. As a matter of fact, I have a tat, beta. Right under mom, right under a number of girls that I've had to cross out over the years. Anyway, what kind of beta woman are you?
I don't know what you're going to say.
Can
I say a number?
Yeah!
1.3.
You're a beta 1.3. What kind of a beta guy are you?
1.0,
okay. Okay, so let's look at betas. What I'm going to do is I'm going to find betas. Minimum beta 1, maximum beta 1.5. Let's do 1.5, just in case, you know, some night you feel really frisky. We're just going to leave everything else alone and say, find some stocks. There's your betas. What's a beta?
What the hell is this? Why did it give me that thing? That's creepy. Okay, there's some betas for you. So in other words, do you notice how this would help you shape a portfolio? Because remember that the beta of the portfolio would be the weight of each, the sum of the weights of each individual component of the portfolio times the beta of that one. So if you wanted to wrap a beta tightly around a, for a portfolio, tightly around the individual securities in it, this is how you do it. Go ahead. I don't know what the hell that's doing there. I didn't ask for that. What? Oh yeah, I've seen it before. Can I make a suggestion to you? Bad. Don't. No. You know, there's something that you just don't want to even ask about in this life, and that's one of those too. I have no idea. They got a couple of them. Why the hell? Oh, I know. Because they think it's an absolute value I'm asking for. So if it finds a beta that's super negative, I mean, okay. Did I ever bring up the term contrarian stocks to you? I might have just barely mentioned it, but back then you didn't listen to me. You don't listen to me now, but what the hell. Okay, there are some stocks that have negative betas. They are unusual. But essentially what that means is that they are counter to the market. They actually do the opposite. And there are even funds, mutual funds, that you can invest in. They're called contrarian funds that are built on portfolios to create a negative beta for the portfolio. Typically, now old school thing, one of the ways that you can find a negative beta stock that where negative betas show up sometimes is in gold mining stocks or stocks that are related to the price of gold. Because remember what I said about the flight to quality from stocks to bonds, bonds to gold, gold to bullets. Well, if the stock market is doing well, gold probably isn't going to be particularly attractive. Gold will go the other way. But if the zombie apocalypse occurs, and we all know that's going to happen someday. The point is, though, that that would mean that the stock market is heading downward. The zombies are going to go right to Wall Street and start eating brains there because those brains are tender, juicy. And so the stock market is going to go to hell, and gold mining stocks are going to go way up. Because I ask you, have you ever seen a zombie eat gold?
Haven't.
You haven't. They go for brains, okay? So the bottom line is that gold will run counter to a market, a greatly improving market, where everything in the world is good and people are happy. That's the kind of world where all of these weird conspiracy theorists and gold bugs and those kinds of people, no one listens to them. But in a market where times are bad, those kinds of people, as wacko and flaky as they are, they suddenly begin, people start to listen to them. And so that's one of the reasons I hate it when the economy is doing good, because no one listens to me anymore. But that essentially, these contrarian funds are out there. And, you know, I actually know two or three investors who have, they have a portfolio of mutual funds. They've got mutual funds of different sectors, like we were talking about before. And two or three of them actually keep a contrarian mutual fund in the portfolio. And I said, well, why are you doing that? Because that actually defeats the return on the others. They said, well, not really, as much as it is a hell of a suppressant for volatility in the larger portfolio. I mean, think of that. If you got a negative beta, when stocks go like this, a lot of that spike is going to be unsystematic risk. So if you got a whole hell of a lot of unsystematic risk going the other way, that's a hellaciously good way to kill off some of the risk in the portfolio, unsystematic risk in the portfolio. So I understand their logic. They also, I'm not sure if this makes much sense or not, from what I understand of trading mutual funds, but they say they like to have that contrarian fund there so that if things start to go bad real fast, they've already got this platform that can move funds into as quickly as possible on that.
I don't know. Like I said, I don't know enough about mutual funds to know if that's actually something that is true or not. Maybe it is. But anyway, there you go. There's some betas. Now, very quickly, let me take you back a screen here on this. And let's look at some betas that are minimum of, let's say, zero and a maximum of 0.5. Look at some very safe securities. Banks. Look at the domination by banks in that. Look at that. Oh, look at that. African Queen Mines, negative beta. See what I mean? Gold stocks, gold mining stocks, negative betas. Interestingly enough, Accord Financial's got a negative 0.18 beta. First Colonial, interestingly. But a resource company. There you go. Again, a negative beta. So I guess I can't shake out that absolute, that negatives and positives. But notice the number of these that look, hard resource companies, timber companies, things like that are banks safe investment kinds of things. Now, let me try something here. I don't know if I can pull this off with this, but I actually kind of like this place to look. One, I'm going to try one and one, see if I can find any stocks that are actually perfect market portfolio. Well, I'll be darned. Well, spank me, Mohammed. You could build Global Tech Advanced, perfect negative one. Lakes Entertainment. Well, entertainment. Well, I guess if all hell breaks loose, go to a park. Go to a. But you see how you could actually, if you wanted to create a market portfolio simulation, you have almost enough here that you could pull that sucker off. Just nail every one of those one betas that are one and just park it right there in the portfolio. Guaranteed, you'd have a beta of a portfolio that was the market portfolio, essentially. Now, what did it look like? There's about 20 stocks there, 15. Now, that's probably not enough to shake out all of the systematic risk, but that's a darn good start for nailing a portfolio. And that's one of the things that I thought I could do here, but I wasn't sure I could do it, is you can actually name an exact beta, and it will give you enough stocks to at least begin to build a portfolio right smack on that beta. The end of the day, though. The end of the day. Mother's work is never done. The capital asset pricing model. CAPM. The capital asset pricing model. Now, if you are ever going to get a finance tattoo at the finance tattoo parlor, now you got to be careful because there are several parlors like that. There's a marketing parlor next door. They're featuring their tattoo. I can't find a job. I'm sorry. And the accounting parlor, they've got that ever-popular tattoo, I'm boring as hell. And then the sales tattoo parlor, which says, I'm drunk as hell, I'm making more than you. But at the finance tattoo parlor, you will see the expected return to a portfolio is going to be the risk-free rate plus beta of the stock or the portfolio times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Gotta bring that capital. Keep going. You can find the expected return to an asset. This, you remember earlier in the course, I was pulling discount the cash flows for this project at, here's how you can do it.
get the expected return using the CAPM. And you're saying, well, isn't that like a stock? Aren't you talking about stocks? Yeah, but you can apply it to individual assets. How would you find the beta of an individual project? One of the ways that it's done is through what are called comps. You find companies that do only that kind of project. That's their exclusive or their main line of business. You get an average of their betas, and that would be the beta that you could use to plug into CAPM to get the discount rate for the cash flows of a project. You know, you're doing your present value, your net present value. You could do that. A piece of terminology, a couple of things here. First things first. This goes back to something I told you early in the course. The risk-free rate, whatever you want to estimate it as, the three-month T-bill or the 10-year T-bill, whatever, treasury note, this is like a base. It's a flat surface, the y-intercept of all investments. If a project does not return at least the risk-free rate, why are you going to do that project? Why are you going to buy that stock if you can buy a riskless security, a riskless government security instead? So every investment begins with a return we expect to be at least the risk-free rate, the opportunity cost of just purely giving up your consumption. So that's why you see that right there on the front, that this is essentially where we have to start. So in other words, if I were to draw something called the securities market line, and this is beta, and this is the expected return to a given security or a portfolio or whatever, at a minimum, at a beta of zero, you should get the risk-free rate. If you look at that formula, if I have a beta of zero, in other words, riskless security, the expected return to the security is going to be zero. Is going to be the risk-free rate. So that's why I said the y-intercept. All securities must deliver that at least. At least we expect them to. They might actually deliver less. Don't get me wrong about that. We're talking about expectations here. But there's a big difference between expectations and reality. We're looking forward in time. I expected to be rich and famous by now. I lied to myself. Okay, now the next thing here is this little animal right here. This R sub market minus R sub F. R sub market minus R sub F. That is called the market premium. More extensively, this is called the market premium over risk-free. This is purely the additional reward to rolling the dice on the market instead of rolling the one on the treasury. It's an extra. It's the bonus for taking risk. You're expected. I've warned you. Sometimes I don't say the expected. R sub market minus R sub F is the expected market premium over risk-free. Write it down. When I say that, that's a darn good hint that it's probably going to show up somewhere on an exam. The expected market premium over the risk-free rate. Sometimes we just say the market premium. That's the slang for it, the market premium. It's how much extra you expect to get by going into the market instead of hiding behind treasuries. Now, here, see the beta times the market premium? This is where beta magnifies or demagnifies the market premium. So in other words, if I had a beta that was 2 on a stock, do you see how that would magnify the market premium? If I had a beta that was 0.5, do you see how that would suppress the market premium? In other words, it is the scalar of the market premium that is peculiar to the stock or to the portfolio. I want you to notice something.
If I have a beta of 1, then the expected return to the portfolio would be R sub F plus 1 times R sub market minus R sub F, which would be R sub F plus R sub market minus R sub F, which is R sub market. So in other words, a beta of 1 is the return to the market. But I've told you all along, the capital asset pricing model is merely the theoretical underpinning of what I've told you all along. A beta of 1 is the market portfolio. So in other words, on the security market line, at a beta of 1.0, we have the return to the market, the expected return. I keep avoiding that. That's the security market line. All stocks will lie on it, or very close to it. There, a lot of research has been done over the years, data, collecting data. We do find things that kind of deviate off it, but we also know that what we're doing is we're looking at snapshots in time. There is a discipline in the market. Think about it this way. So we see stocks clustering, their return and their beta cluster along this line in real data, in real scatter plots. We see it. And when we see things off it, the first thing we want to do is say, well, let's look at it again in a few weeks or a few days, and we'll see that there is this market discipline that puts things back on it. We do, however, see some things that are anomalies. One is there allegedly, and we argue about this a lot, we see what's called a small cap anomaly. A small cap anomaly is this cluster of stocks whose returns are higher than they should be if the securities market line is linear. We see that there's some of us who argue that's actually not really there, because all we're doing is we're collecting data on public companies. That's all we've got the data for, is public companies. So private companies which would tend to be small, we might see a lot of those private companies down in here. So we really can't tell if the average of them is sitting on the line, because the ones we can't see are invisible. They might be down here somewhere because, again, they aren't publicly traded. We can't get data on them. So is the effect real? I don't know. There are a couple of other effects that seem to point, you get to this point where, well, I found this anomaly, so the capital asset pricing model ain't true. Well, no, you just want to find a way so you don't have to do the math. There's one that's called the January effect that seems to show that in January, certain types of stocks are above the security market line for a while. Is that true? Is that not true? I'm not so sure about that. The January effect, there's a question that we would have to ask ourselves. If there's an effect that deviates from our expectations all the time, how is it that it keeps happening? Why is it that we don't make it go away by leaning toward it? Let me explain. This is called an efficient, in mathematics, there's a term called frontier. A frontier or an envelope. And the envelope concept is one where there is a performance boundary above which things or below which things don't happen. We see it in physics and engineering all the time, these performance envelopes, that you can be below the performance envelope, but we can't get above that, at least with the current technology. We see that in engines all the time. We see that in all kinds of parts of our lives all the time, even in human performance. Now, you can move that boundary over time, but at any given time, there's this envelope. This is a linear envelope. So in other words, suppose that there were a stock that was above the securities market line. Its beta is, let's say, about 1.2, but it is returning way more than the securities market line says it should, based upon its risk. Well, there's a theoretical logic that should move into the practical world there. If you got a stock that is performing above what it should, wouldn't that be a stock that the gurus and the geniuses on Wall Street would rush to grab? And as they rush to grab it, the price would go up, which would cause the return to go down. That's why this envelope seems to exist. In real world, in theory, it's great, but in the real world, the envelope is there because things that deviate away from it, the stock market will. If you got a stock that is getting more than it's expected, the risk indicates, there should be a lot of buying activity that would drive the price up and drive the return back down to the discipline line, to the envelope. Similarly, suppose you had a stock that had a very high beta, but it didn't even return what it's supposed to. Well, that would a stock that has high risk and a low return, well, investors are going to dump that stock. They're going to sell that off. They're going to get rid of it. And as the price, and that'll cause the price to drop, and as price goes down, yield should go up. So there's like this disciplining force on both sides in real life. That is why the theory prevails, is that there are so many market participants that if market participants see a stock that is returning more than its risk indicates it should, the market participants will buy that stock rapidly, pushing the price up and therefore the return back down to the security market line. On the other hand, if a stock is highly risky but its return sucks, then what that would indicate is that that there's going to be short sellers, holders of the stock that are going to sell, driving the stock price down, which should push the return up on it. That's the market discipline, and that's why the securities market line seems to exist in the real world. And again, there are stocks we see that are off the line. And whether or not what we're seeing is actually real or not, you get an awful lot of... A lot of these folks, there's two kinds of people who are always trying to pick off the capital asset pricing model and show that it's flawed or that it doesn't hold. One type of person is a person who just wants to be a contrary person. I don't want to learn a theory. There's nothing there for me. Another kind are the research academics trying to buck for tenure who want to find some dramatic result that blows out all of the old ways, and so everyone falls in love with them, they get their Nobel Prize, they get their tenure, and they get their grants, and they become lifers in some stale institution. No, there's no one here like that. But the point there being that for the most part, and in our normal lives, this is the world that prevails. This capital asset pricing model actually does work. So if you are thinking of going to that tattoo parlor, there is no better tattoo for you to get. And I would recommend that there's a guy there named Earl. Earl knows his formula. He invests. He is the best. And he will make it right with you so you can forever remember the capital asset pricing model. That's all I have for you. Go home.